happens to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to, I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett. As always, Writers on Writing brings you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers. And I'm here now with Charles Bock, author of Beautiful Children. And coming up in the second half hour, I'll be joined by Manil Suri, talking about his second novel, The Age of Shiva. Charles Bock was born in Las Vegas. He has an MFA from Bennington College and has received fellowships from Yaddo, UCross, and the Vermont Studio Center. His debut novel, Beautiful Children, was 10 years in the making, published by Random House, and we're fortunate enough to be talking to him this morning. Charles, welcome.
Hey, Marie. Hey, everyone out there in UC Irvine anteater land.
Are you an anteater fan?
You know what? One of my brothers was involved for a little while with the UC Irvine anteater basketball team back in the late 80s, early 90s.
So I do know
who the mascot is, that Irvine's the Anteaters, and I even know the name of Scott Brooks is the alumni who played for the Anteaters, who went on to the NBA. So I know my Anteater trivia as well.
You know more than I do here. you know, there's a lot of ground to cover in this novel. So great.
Yeah.
Let's dive in. Let's tell us first about Beautiful Children and where the idea for it originated, and a little bit about the book.
Sure. The book is beautiful. It takes place in Las Vegas. It's a novel about a 12-year-old boy, Newell Ewing, who goes out on a Saturday night with an older friend and doesn't come home. The spine and really the heart of the book probably follows the next year in his parents' lives while their kid is missing, as they're trying to find out what happened to him and also to keep their marriage together. Another thread follows Newell and his friend Kenny as they're out on the town in Vegas on that fateful Saturday night. Everyone they meet gets a little thread and has a story and involvement in the plot. Eventually, it moves into the world of teen runaways. It moves into the adult part of Las Vegas with strip clubs and adult movies. There's a fair amount of the hope and the best impulses of all of us should also be in the book, because while it's dark, it's not exploitative or dark for no reason. And hopefully there's some jokes that are pretty decent as well.
That's a great summary, because there's so much about this book. And if I had to sum it up, I would ask you, because that's a much better job than I could have done. That's
great. Well, you know what? I have to work on it, because in trying to explain it to people, it's just, you know, it's a big matzo ball. There's a lot there.
And, there's a lot there.
Yeah. So yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about your childhood in Vegas and
sure.
Your own experiences with the city. And that part of this takes place in a pawn shop.
Right.
And, you know, it just strikes me. I know that part of your growing up happened in a pawn shop. And it strikes me as, you know, kind of the epitome of last resort and desperation. And, you know, to see adults out of control and desperate at such a young age. I'm wondering what that did to your psychological development, and if you can talk about that experience and its
sure.
impact on the book.
Oh, yeah. It's a good question. You don't know that they're out of control when you're a kid. I mean, you know, there's something going on. This is what my parents did. It's what they continue to do. It's what they're doing today, right now, even in their 70s. But when you're growing up, you know, I would go in the back of the store, I'd get my candy, I'd have a soda, I would file tickets or whatever, you know, just as a way of keeping me occupied in the afternoons. Maybe I'd bring homework with me. And you do see people who are on, you know, gambling binges would come in and they would pawn stuff, not so they could go home, but so they could go back in and win the money they'd lost back.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would trade in, you know, their ticket home. They would sell their plane ticket or trade it back in the bus ticket. You'd also find an awful lot of people who, you know, they gambled a lot and they worked in Vegas and maybe they lost their money and now they came in to pawn something to keep their lights on. And it wouldn't be a big dramatic event. It was just how they lived their life. This was in the days before ATMs, were a common part of, you know, our culture. And it does have an effect. There's no way you can not look out from the back and see these people come in and not want, you know, kind of understand that there's a certain thing going on. There's a vibe inside a pawn shop that's unmistakable. Sometimes I would see people who would be told their jewelry wasn't worth, you know, half of what they paid for it, that they had gotten ripped off, that they weren't going to get their loan, and you know, and you would see the result of that, you know, like, and sometimes it could be tantrums and anger and what have you. I do think, I know I'm rambling, but I do think that it gave me a sense of, you know, I wanted something more for those people. I wanted more for my parents. And when I became a writer, when I understood that writing was my thing or that I was going to try and write, when tapping into that that emotion or kind of, you know, the vibe that's in that store gave me a certain perspective on humanity in general that mm-hmm. I think is carried through the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think so.
Amazing. Yeah, Vegas, you know, it's such a city that's always reinventing itself, and it's
right.
destroying itself and rebuilding itself. And that, too, seemed to really reflect what your characters were going through. I think, you know, on some level, a lot of them were destroying themselves and rebuilding themselves and wanting something better and not knowing how to get there. And it seemed like just the, you know, the perfect setting for the background of a city that's doing the same thing.
Thank you. It is that. I hoped for that. That was something I tried for and had a conscious decision, you know, that Vegas takes the Eiffel Tower and turns it into a casino. It takes Bellagio and turns it into a casino. There's a hollowing out. There's a reinvention. You know, Vegas, it's constantly reinventing things and adding to itself. And yet it's still pretty much Vegas. You know, like yeah. 10 years ago, there may have been the family theme to get people to the casinos and get them to gamble. Then it became the adult theme to get people into the casinos and get them to gamble. And now it's the casinos and the gambling are just part of the show. The show is much bigger, but it's still designed to get people to Las Vegas so they can go and have a great time and blow their brains out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the yep. city is still, you know, it's this tremendous, it's like this apex of a certain slice of popular culture and a certain kind of the American dream. And you just go there and whatever you want, you just have to reach out for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways that worked out well for me in terms of, because it makes a nice metaphor about a certain part of our culture and a certain direction that I think a lot of us could make an argument that, you know, American culture is moving more towards Las Vegas than, say, it would be moving towards Vermont.
Right. Right.
Know? Yeah.
I assume you spoke with a number of homeless youths and yeah. runaways during the course of writing the book. And I'm wondering how accessible they made their world to you and, you know, how much you can penetrate that world from the outside, you know, enough to write about it and, you know, just kind of what you learned from them.
That's a really good question. I think if I hadn't been a deeply unhappy teenager, if I hadn't had certain experiences in my 20s, it probably, no amount of talking to them probably would have helped. I did a lot of research. I did a lot of research that, you know, quote research, where it was really I would see someone and sit down and go get them Crest and go get them some food and give them, you know, what little money I had, because most of the time I was writing the book I was broke, and sit down and just kind of, you know, listen to their stories and not take notes, but just kind of try and absorb them. I also obviously read police reports and talked with counselors and what have you. If I hadn't felt that way, if I, as a young man, and if I hadn't known what it's like to want to escape everything from your life or to want to experience the world and then to go out there and have, you know, disappointments and find out that what you're bargaining for is so much different, or what you're getting is so much different than what you bargained for, I don't think that that any amount of note-taking or research could have helped. But I also probably wouldn't have been wanting to write about lost teenagers if I didn't have that kernel inside of me. You know, our subjects sometimes pick us.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
You know, I'd love to give you an opportunity to read and kind of introduce our listeners to this world and give us a platform to jump off from. Can you read to us?
Oh, I'd love to. This is a section more about the boy's parents, Newell's parents, Lincoln and Lorraine, and it's I would say a couple minutes. It's not too long, and it's fairly self-explanatory.
I'll remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Charles Bach, author of Beautiful Children.
All right. During those first frantic days after Newell disappeared, Lincoln and Lorraine survived because of each other, the problems and troubles of their marriage giving way to its core strengths. chief of which was tenderness. Born of history, reaching beyond language, the bonds provided some small measure of shelter and allowed the couple to weather so much niggling and unreality. Friends and relations descending upon the house like a well-intentioned swarm. Officers tramping clumsily through each room, unfailingly leaving the toilet seat up. Neither Lincoln nor Lorraine could bring themselves to eat more than a muffin here or there. Sleep was sporadic, coming when it could not be kept at bay any longer. Yet they had that tenderness, those small private moments. The afternoon they'd successfully gotten Lorraine's parents onto their flight back home, for example. And the morning Lorraine's dad had picked up his camper and hugged his daughter-in-law. After he was gone, they'd been able to sit at the kitchen table and pick over a tray of banana bread that someone had dropped off. Just sit there and wait for the next pot of coffee to brew, exhaling as much as possible. Being with each other. Being there for each other. Still, she was not ready to have him back in what she privately thought of as her bed. Lorraine was sorry for this, but it didn't feel right to her. Not just yet. Lincoln's disappointment was as wordless as it was obvious. Nonetheless, he respected her feelings and bided his time. He slept in the guest bedroom and shaved in the guest bathroom. He dressed and went downstairs each morning, kissed his wife on the cheek, gave her a hug of support, and went over whatever details needed to be discussed. And then Lincoln went off to work, leaving Lorraine alone in the silence, alone inside her own head. The relentless August sun was giving way to September days that were as unremarkable as sunlight, days that were as beautiful as any this planet had seen. Their beauty tortured Lorraine. And no matter how much she promised herself she would stop, she found herself watching videotapes of Newell. She couldn't help it. She had to see her son.
Mm-hmm. That was Charles Bach reading from his novel, Beautiful Children. You know, it feels like no easy feat to acquire and maintain the voices of so many diverse and different characters. You know, we go from Lorraine here, who's... this grieving mother, to, you know, really kind of the deep and seedy sex underworld of Vegas. And I'm curious how you, if you can talk about the subject of voice and if there are devices or tricks that you use that allow you to kind of effectively inhabit all these heads.
You know, it's a good question. I think one thing that helped would be just on a daily basis, if I was in a Lorraine scene, to go back and to start reading the beginning of that scene or the previous scene, that because there were so many voices to worry about, that when I would switch from one to the other, it would help to familiarize myself again and again with each voice, to get inside that head. Because the beginning is itself a third person, or the point of view is a third person omniscient, and it jumps from A to B to C to D. It helped also that I had a flat beginning that was malleable enough to adapt to all these.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it wasn't such a huge leap or such a to go from A to B. But honestly, when I would finish one section and have to move, when I would finish a Lorraine, let's say, and then go to a pony boy who is a, you know, this hard, aggressive street kid who really is take no prisoners, I would have to, it was a big shift.
Yeah.
It would be a constant shift, and I would have to, it would take a day or two each time to get to familiarize myself again, even years into the book, because there's a difference, and thankfully that third person voice, you know, smooths it over and makes it much more palatable for a reader.
Mm.
But it's a good question, because it was a pain. I'm not gonna lie.
Did you stay with a voice for a period of weeks or months before you'd move to another voice?
No, you know, I would do one scene at a time.
Okay.
And then a lot while I was writing those scenes, usually I would take notes or add things to their future scenes or go back to their past. so that I would be fairly consistent. But I wrote the book. I think one of the things that allows someone to stay with, excuse me, a book for a very long time like this, that where you know where it took me forever to write, is that there's so many different voices that none of them get boring because you don't spend too much time on one at one time. If I would have spent months in a row on a Lincoln, it might have been harder than jumping back into him and rediscovering once again, you know what, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I like this guy. I'm going to spend some time with him now.
You know, he was my favorite
guy. I do think that as long as your writer is entertained and interested in their own universe and in the work they're writing on, even if they're kind of even if it's tiring and even if there's a lot of knots and stuff to figure out, if you're interested and you want to figure it out and you're kind of entertained by what you're doing, that's a pretty good sign.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you know you were going to have this many characters from the outset, you know, 10 years ago when you started? Did you
I had no idea. I had no idea what I was doing. I really, when I started, I didn't have as many good characters. I had some cardboard cutouts. I started with a smaller cast. The parents were there, but they were two-dimensional and minor, and eventually the family becomes the heart of the book. You know, in a second or third draft, I was bright enough to figure that one out. Bing, I think, becomes a much better character in second or third draft. That things added, because I understood that the world was more full and that it wasn't working the way I had it. You know, or it could work better, or it was more entertaining. And maybe some of it, you know, another writer might have discovered these characters and thought, oh, that's a good short story. But for some reason, I would find ways to incorporate them and make things more complicated. And a part of me loves, you know, there's a part of me that loves a complicated good complicated book that you can read through, and it doesn't read to be so complicated, but it has a lot going on, and thinks that there's something wonderful about being able to switch channels and, oh, here's this new person I care about, or I'd forgotten they were there, and now here they're back, and I'm so glad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was wondering about the writing for over a long period of time, and you said something which I thought was really wise, I think, in another interview, which was, you know, it wouldn't have been published if it took me 9.5 years. It takes what it takes.
Yeah.
And the risk, I suppose, is the forest from the trees problem. You know, when you're writing and unpacking and scrapping things and rewriting until, you know, as an author, I would think it's difficult to know what was in there and what you took out and what you wrote and forgot.
It is. That is a real problem. It is a real problem. My wife and I sometimes, we would talk about things, and she would forget if I had taken something out of a draft or not. And I would, and there is that level of, geez, what's in there anymore? I don't even know. And that was a danger, and I probably succumbed to that quite a few times. It's interesting because, you know, this is how I didn't want it to take 10 years. I never thought it would take 10 years, but you know, the only person who, in the end, who is responsible for that is me, and I didn't mind spending the time, and I hope, and no one should read the book thinking, boy, is this worth 10 years? Hopefully, it's one book, and hopefully, I think it's a good book, and some people seem to agree with me about that. but it does, because it took so long, doesn't mean, boy, it better be great.
No, right.
You know, I wish I could have done faster, you know.
No, I was more curious about if there were techniques you used. You know, did you go back and outline chapters for yourself to know what was in where? And were there things that you used to keep yourself organized over the course of the time?
You have to have outlines. For me, I had to have outlines. And I had to know in an upcoming scene what needs to happen in this scene. You know, what plot points do I need to, let's say, hit to get this person where they need, where I want them, would like for them to go. And then, you know, you have the freedom and the air to discover how they're going to get there or how you're going to do that. Or you have all the notes that you've been keeping of little details you want to work in or a good line of dialogue you think might work that someone might say. But it helps to have a map that tells you where you want to be so that then you can deal with it and do all the fun stuff of writing and discover how you're going to hit those notes.
Mm-hmm. The malleable map. I like that.
Yeah. It really is. Thank you. Yeah.
One of the things I found really interesting was the treatment of sex in the novel and the different prisms through which it's viewed. Almost every single character, I think you explored their kind of separate and distinct relationship to sex, which is, no easy task for this cast.
Right.
I think it was an interesting way to delineate them from each other and kind of a new way to explore, culture and psychology. Did you consciously set out to use that as kind of a recurring, I don't know if you want to say theme or device or?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not the great theme of the book, because I don't even know if the book has a great theme beyond, that we're all connected in certain weird ways.
Mm-hmm.
But, in an idea of doing better towards one another. But there was no doubt that if I'm going to do this if I'm going to write about Vegas, I have to deal with the adult side. And if you're going to deal with the adult side, then sex becomes part of it. And I was writing this book at a time where the adult film industry moved from videotapes to DVDs to internet. So it really,
wow.
It did not just blew up, but it blew up like five times and had a nuclear explosion.
Right.
And, it's such a, it becomes part of the American pop culture landscape. If you're going to write about Vegas, to a certain degree, that has to, that becomes part of the equation. So, yeah, let's explore each character's relationship to their sexual selves, and technology becomes part of it because of internet porn and the teen runaways. Well, that is also part of the adult world, and that there does seem to be a line that connects it all. And so it was a big challenge, and it's wonderful that you caught that, Marie, because it's not sex for the sake of sex. It's not writing sex so that I could have a hot scene.
Right.
But it's more for, this is a avenue of the modern psyche, and we all have it, and we have it in different degrees, and we respond to different things, and what does that mean?
Yeah.
How is it possible that I could rummage around in there and try and explore that a little bit?
Yeah, really interesting and well done. It was also interesting to me that the strands, there are a lot of strands, and they sort of intersect, but they don't always intersect. The characters were really on their own path and journey, and that probably also reflects the runaway experience that you...
Yeah.
You really are on your own distinct...
Yeah, I think so. You are, and there's places where you can go and meet up with people, and there's people who know each other even from different towns, and there's certain areas that are kind of places, crash pads, or in San Francisco parks where people even leave like hot plates and stuff for the next bunch of runaways. But you're on your own.
You're
completely on your own. And I tried to make a manuscript where people could bounce off each other or move in opposition to each other, even as they could also come together or overlap or just miss or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any last minute advice for writers?
I would say this to anyone, any writer, just, keep at it. That we need good books. The publishing industry, people want to say no because it's easier, but you can be humiliated and you think you did something good and they'll find a way to humiliate you more. But the world needs good books. And however much time it takes, or however quickly it happens, something good. We need good books. We need people who love books. And you just stay with it. Stay with it. And, I consider myself complete utter evidence of someone who's the fact that a good book can find a life. I wrote spent 9 years on it with no agent. I spent a year after that working with one person. I'd never met the editor who bought my book. I had never met most of the people at Random, all the people at Random House who supported it. A good book will find a life, and maybe it won't be at Random House, but it'll be somewhere, and I'll be happy to read it, and I know a lot of other people will too. So you stay at it.
I love that. I love that. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning. This is great.
Oh, I loved it, Marie. Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Me too. That was Charles Bach, author of Beautiful Children, available now and published by Random House. I should also mention that Charles has the most amazing website that you really should check out if you want more information about the book or about him. Feel free to visit www.beautifulchildren.net for more information. And just a generally great tour of the author, the book, independent music, and a lot of other great stuff. We're going to take a short break. Don't go anywhere. Manil Suri will be with me for the second half hour, so please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
What is this profession called coaching? What is a coach? No, not football, not soccer, not even tennis. By now, you must have heard the terms life coaching or executive coaching or even business coaching. Come find out on Coaching Conversations with me, Patricia Hirsch, where I interview coaches from around the world, mainly from the 12,000 plus membership of the International Coach Federation, where coaches are becoming certified. Coaching Conversations with Patricia Hirsch, alternate Fridays at 9 a.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM Irvine. Find out more on the show's website at www.patriciahirsch.com. That's PatriciaHirsch.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes public radio page or Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here now with Manil Suri. Manil was born and raised in Bombay, which is now Mumbai, India. He came to the United States as a student when he was 20. His first published fiction in English was The Seven Circles, a short story that appeared in The New Yorker on Valentine's Day 2000. The Death of Vishnu, his first novel, debuted worldwide in January of 2001. In addition to being published by Norton in the United States and Bloomsbury in the UK, the novel has been translated into 22 foreign languages. Manil was named by Time magazine as a person to watch in 2000, and he received a Guggenheim Fellowship for fiction in 2004. But today we'll be focusing on his latest work, the second in his trilogy, The Age of Shiva, published by Norton. Manil, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start by, before we tackle the book, by talking a bit about your childhood in India and whether your early life experiences there informed this novel.
Well, to some extent, although I think I used more of it in the first novel, I grew up in a large apartment. We had one room out of this big flat, and there were three other families that shared this apartment with us. And interestingly enough, the three other families were Muslim and we were Hindu, which is almost exactly the reverse proportion of the population in India, which is predominantly Hindu. Hmm. So I had this, I've always had this great sensitivity to Hindu-Muslim relations, and so that's one of the things I explore in both novels.
Yeah, interesting. And you've talked about mining your family's lives, maybe not just your own, but your grandparents' lives for the novel. Did your family's experience mirror any of the lives of the characters in this book?
One thing that I did want to do was have the characters in this book come from Pakistan in the partition. India was partitioned into Pakistan and India in 1947 when the British left. And my parents actually got married that year. They got married on the 10th of July, 1947, and the partition took place on the 15th of August. And so they had to really flee. They couldn't even open their wedding presents because people were being killed over there. And so they just left everything behind and came to Delhi. And it basically killed my grandfather, who was a doctor and had to leave everything behind. So that's a story that's always been in my mind. And so when I had to look for a background for my characters, I said, aha, I have to put this in.
Interesting. And you've talked about having perhaps, you know, more humble beginnings than other contemporary Indian writers. And I suppose with any country or place, for some reason, it feels particularly so with India. There just seem like there are many Indias coexisting at once, you know, vastly different experiences being had. I don't know if that's simply a matter of wealth or if it's, you know, status or religion or education. Is that perception correct or is that...
It's absolutely correct. People talk about diversity here, but if you go to India, you really see just how diverse that country is. There are differences in religion, there's differences in wealth and education, language, skin tone, class, caste. I mean, there are just all sorts of differences. And interestingly enough, people discriminate regularly against everyone else based on those differences, so you kind of develop a thick skin about it. But that's one of the amazing things about India. Strangely enough, it's something that actually keeps the country together in a perverse way. And it's one of the reasons that democracy has thrived in the country, because that's really the only way you can govern such a diverse population. When India got its freedom, people made regular predictions, people in the West, about India disintegrating within 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. And that fortunately hasn't happened. The country has sort of pulled through.
Yeah, it's interesting. And It's the more I read about India, and I've been drawn to the literature for a long time, and it you know, the more I read, the more sort of inaccessible and impenetrable the culture and country seems to me. You know, it just feels like the mystere grows and the psychology becomes more complex. And so I love the literature out of here. I feel like it's, you know, kind of the closest I can get to it, but certainly not understand it still.
Well, I think part of it is just... You know, I mean, like, that's one of the aims I had of writing this book, where I was really looking at where the country came from. How did it evolve? You know, the British left, and what happened after that? How did it grow up? How did it come of age? And I think you really need to go back to that and see those formative years to understand better what's going on now, where, you know, India is sort of poised at the head of this Asian century, and you really see the new and the old clashing. Well, where did that clash start?
Yeah, interesting. So tell us about The Age of Shiva and your concept for the trilogy of novels.
So The Age of Shiva is actually a book about India after independence, and it's a very male-dominated society. It's about 1955, 7 or 8 years after independence, when the book starts. And the central character, Meera, is only 17 at that time, and she's making her way through this landscape, which is very patriarchal. And there are few choices really available to women at that time. There are all these roles that are thrust upon them, whether they be that of a mother or a daughter or a wife. And Meera instinctively reacts against all of these. She keeps trying to forge her own destiny. And so she makes a lot of questionable choices as she negotiates this path. And it's only when her son is born that she really finds that here is a way for her to be happy, and she invests all her chances of happiness in him. So as I said, what's happening in the background is that India is coming of age, just like Meera is developing as a person in the foreground. And this fits in nicely with the trilogy, because the first book, The Death of Vishnu, you talked about just how complex and how diverse India is. Well, The Death of Vishnu was a snapshot of the country, sort of a microcosm of the country, as illustrated by this one apartment building where you had all these classes and religions and so on coexisting. And so that was a snapshot of India in contemporary times, like the 80s or 90s. This book actually shows how we evolved to that position from independence to what's contemporary times. And the next book, which is going to be the birth of Brahma, or the search for Brahma, is going to actually say what can happen in the future, what could happen tomorrow, how can this story end. So it'll be somewhat set in the future.
I love that. I also really appreciated how well you balanced telling us kind of just enough information to make us aware of the mythological underpinnings of the novel, but nothing was ever over-explained. You know, I guess by us here, I'm referring to American audiences, who are probably generally less familiar, but it was a nice balance.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think in this book in particular, Shiva is very much in the background. The mythology, they're just a couple of myths that I've sort of taken and tried to illustrate what happens when human characters take on the form of gods. You know, all these mythology, they always involve divine characters, divine entities who are supposed to be perfect. Well, if imperfect human beings are put in the same position, what happens then? And the central myth, which I just find amazing, is about Shiva and his spouse Parvati. Shiva is often called the god of destruction, but he's also an ascetic. He withdraws from the world, and it's without his participation that the world starts winding down, and that's why he's called the destroyer. Well, he's away out there meditating the whole time. And this creates this intense longing in the minds of people who cannot attain him, who love him but cannot attain him. And so Parvati is left by herself while Shiva is off meditating. And she finds that she's very lonely, and one day she decides that she's going to make a little boy out of her own body. She uses sandalwood paste, she uses her own bath water, and she sculpts this little boy. And this boy turns out to be so delightful that she just spends all her time in his company and forgets all about Shiva. She just frolics around in the forest with him. And so this is the myth that I've used, where Meera, the central character, develops this intense, almost obsessive love for her son.
Very nice. That leads us nicely into the reading. I'm wondering if you can read to us a little bit from the novel and take us into your world.
Okay, I'll start right at the beginning, and this is actually, interestingly enough, the first couple of pages that I wrote down when I started the novel in about 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Every time I touch you, every time I kiss you, every time I offer you my body, Ashwin, Do you know how tightly you shut your eyes as with your lips you search my skin? Do you know how you thrust your feet towards me, how you reach out your arms, how the sides of your chest strain against my palms? Are you aware of your fingers brushing against my breast, their tips trying to curl around something to hold on to, but slipping instead against my smooth flesh? Ashwin, do you notice the wetness emerge from my nipples and spill down the slopes of my chest? Is that your tongue that I feel? Are you able to steal a taste or two? Ashwin, your eyes still closed, drops of moisture dappling your nose. Do you know how innocent you look, how helpless, as I guide the nipple towards your mouth? For an instant, I feel like teasing you, drawing my nipple across your lips, but only for a touch, and swinging it away, watching your tongue dart out in confusion, the fingers still opening and closing and curling, worry beginning to crinkle your face. And that helplessness, that exquisite helplessness in your expression, that need for my body, for the nipple that is yours, for the breast I've so cruelly taken away. Yes, love can be capricious, can it not, my sweet? But of course, I relent before I even begin. Your look suffuses me with guilt. I let your mouth close around me. I feel the pressure of your gums, your lips. The power in your jaws surprises me. A little more strength, and I can see there will be pain. Your tongue pulls against my nipple. So practiced, so persuasive, so determined, how does it know what to do? I feel myself responding. Each tug brings liquid flooding up, engorging my breast, pushing out into your insistent mouth. Your feet twist and turn against my belly as you feed. Your hands finally find purchase on my breast. Fingers playing out around tiny palms, your orb, your world held in your hands. I lose myself in the rhythm of your intake. Am I imagining it, or is there a parallel rhythm that echoes inside me? A longing that rises through my body and trembles under my skin. I feel myself flush. I feel the color spread through my chest. Then I see your face, your forehead losing its worry, your eyelids no longer wrinkled tight. There is nothing, I think to myself, as you let go of my nipple and turn to me filled. Nothing that can be as satisfying as this.
That was Manel Suri reading from his latest novel, The Age of Shiva. I'm curious about, and this passage brought it up, what I would think would be a very tricky task, and that is not only writing from a woman's perspective, but writing from such intimate and deeply personal and uniquely feminine experiences, breastfeeding being one, but pregnancy and sexuality. You bucked the tired advice of write what you know.
Right.
Given that, how do you approach writing what perhaps you don't know and can't experience?
Well, in the beginning, I thought I should really read up on this. So I read everything I could lay my hands on, things about breastfeeding. I read classic feminist texts like Of Woman Born by Adrienne Rich, which talks about the relationship between a woman and her son. And I did a lot of research in that way. But at some point, I said, this is not really getting me where I need to be. And so I just had to step back. And I really had to think, what would happen if an infant was at my own breast? Where would the mouth be? What would it feel like? Where would the legs be? Where would the head be? And it was only when I really started putting myself in that place that I was able to write. And interestingly enough, the voice that came out is exactly what I read out. It was Mira addressing her son. And that's the voice that I continued the novel in. Of course, there were points along the way that I really had to step little by little into Mira's psyche and to really start looking at the world through her eyes and to look at her own son through her eyes. It was a very intimate experience in some ways and a very long experience. It took me 7 years. And the hardest thing was to figure out whether women and men think differently at certain junctures. So I would, if I got to such a juncture, I would really say, okay, what would my mother do in this position? Or what would my aunt do in this position? And that's how I would sort of proceed from there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the most vivid scenes for me, and I don't want to give too much away here, so I'll discuss it somewhat generally, was a funeral scene. It's vivid, and what I love is perhaps in this scene more than any other, the culture is so foreign to the American experience. What is the cultural approach to death and the afterlife? I assume this was a traditional funeral ceremony.
Yeah, it was. A much more traditional ceremony would be where the son actually burns the father, let's say, on a funeral pyre made out of wood, as opposed to a crematorium, as is done here. But the idea is that afterwards, the son is supposed to really take the skull and split it open, and that way the father's soul is liberated and goes on to the next life, because you're supposed to be reincarnated over and over again. And this is the reason why it's so important in India to have male children, why there's so much pressure on women to have sons, because the son is needed to liberate the father's soul. And so what happens is that as a result, when women do have a son, they're so drawn to the son. There's this intense bond that arises between them that is perhaps stronger than in other cultures.
Interesting. I'm also curious what it's like to work with Mira. It kind of makes a series of bad choices, let's say, and it's certainly understandable in many cases, but ultimately bad in the end. And, you know, in any good novel, the characters are flawed, at least, you know, interesting characters are flawed. But I'm curious if it's difficult to work with a character who is so undermined by her own self-destructive behavior, or, you know, where she's making poor choices. Is it hard to work with a character like that?
Actually, I would probably disagree in some sense. I think that I think her choices are not necessarily as bad as they might seem at the outset. I mean, it's really like, how is she going to determine her own destiny? And it turns out that the path she chooses, again, is not the most traditional path, but it is right for her in some perverse way. And at the end, she does find some sort of redemption, and there is hope for her and everyone around her, as the last chapter shows. Mm-hmm. But more than that, I think what I was really trying to do was to point out the real dynamic is between Mira and her father. Her father is this very liberal, secular person who wants to educate his daughters and so on, but is still very, very he's very oppressive in his own way, because he's always trying to push her into all these things. And so Mira ends up in this mode where she keeps reacting against things that he does. And what I had in mind, sort of in the background of my mind, was the dynamic between India and the West, where the West is this sort of patriarchal figure, and the West has always wanted India to behave a certain way, India, which is Mira in our case. And India basically went its own way. If you look at what Nehru did or what Indira Gandhi did, you know, they never behaved the way the West wanted it to. They had this whole non-aligned movement where they refused to kowtow to American pressure, let's say. As a result, you know, some of those choices weren't the best. People starved. But in this meandering way, India has sort of found its own way to a pretty stable position. And I should just point out for listeners that at one point things were so bad between India and the West that Nixon actually deployed the Seventh Fleet against India during the war for Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. I've read that you've studied early on with Vikram Chandra and later with Michael Cunningham, who really gave you the breakthrough you needed with your first novel. Was there advice from these writers that sustains you, or that you found particularly helpful when crafting either one of the novels?
Yeah, I think with Vikram Chandra, he was the first person to really encapsulate this idea that you just mentioned about characters not being too perfect, because it's nice to have flaws in a character and show a much more rounded human character rather than someone perfect. So he really gave me some such pointer for one of the characters in a short story that I'd written. And then Michael Cunningham, he actually saw a little more of the novel that was in progress, and he really gave me confidence. I was, at that time, I had writer's block, and I was wondering whether I should just give up writing and just concentrate on my day job. And then I went and took this workshop, and he was the first person to really write down on a piece of paper, you are a writer. You have to do this. You have to finish this at any cost. And that just gave me so much encouragement that it helped me finish the novel.
Mm. Yeah, I should mention to our listeners, if they don't know, that that writing is your evening job, and you're a mathematics professor by day. And you've written some interesting things on the synergy between writing and mathematics. I assume that you have to stay on a fairly strict regimen to keep up with your schedule.
Oh, I'm terrible, though. I'm completely undisciplined. And that's probably one of the reasons it took me 7 years to write this novel.
Do you have any last-minute advice, particularly for people who can't devote, 9 hours a day to the world of writing? How to sustain things and how to keep yourself going?
I think that's actually the best way, that if you have another job and the writing is a hobby, which it was for me for many years, and I just got so much out of it. It was sort of a secret existence. You're really in today's world, you're really pushed into doing just one thing and doing it as well as you can, and people don't take you seriously if you start spending time on other stuff. So that's why I actually decided that I was going to, do this writing as something that would give another dimension to my life. And it gave me a lot of enjoyment in that way. And now, if you're lucky, things will get published. If you're not, well, you're still getting a lot out of it. And that's really the main thing. That was the main thing for me. Incidentally, once the book came out, two colleagues in my department came up to me and confessed that they were actors in secret. So there are lots of people who do these things, and I think that's the fun part.
I love that. Manil, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Manil Suri, author of The Age of Shiva, available now and published by Norton. Feel free to check out his website at www.manilsuri.com for more details and information. I'll leave you with a bit of advice from William Faulkner. Read, read, read. Read everything. Trash, classics, good and bad, and see how they do it. Just like a carpenter who works as an apprentice and studies the master, read. You'll absorb it, then write. If it's good, you'll find out. If it's not, throw it out the window. Barbara will be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 with Charles Baxter and Mara Hornbacher. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.